Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Paige Mackey-Murray, and I represent the appellant, Brett Peerat. This was not an easy case for the trial court. The court entered its permanent orders 3 months after the preliminary orders hearing, citing for the delay, the complexity of the case, and the court's overbearing docket. I think we can add to that the fact that this was a highly contentious case and that one of the parties, Mr. Peerat, appeared pro se. So that created a challenging environment for the trial court. And unfortunately, the trial court made a number of errors in the permanent orders. And these were not decisions that were purposefully made in the exercise of its equitable discretion. These were simply oversights and errors in the permanent orders. There are two specific errors that I want to talk about most today. The first one has to do with the second mortgage payments, and the second has to do with imputation of income and voluntary unemployment. With regard to the second mortgage payments, what I'd like the court to take away today, what I think is really critical in this case, is that these payments were not child support payments, and they were not maintenance payments. They were marital expense payments that were to be made to a third party. They didn't fall under 1410.122. They did not become judgments automatically when not paid. They became judgments in this case at permanent orders. The primary bulk of those payments became judgments at permanent orders. In paragraph 6 of the permanent orders, the court included from August 1st, 2009 to May 2010, granted the verified entry of support judgment at permanent orders, and made that a judgment in Mrs. Peerat's favor. In paragraph 58 of the permanent orders, the court added to that payments from May 2010 to May 2011 and made that a judgment in Mrs. Peerat's favor at the time of permanent orders. So these were not payments that Mrs. Peerat was entitled to. These were payments that Mr. Peerat was to make to a third party, and it wasn't until permanent orders that she had an entitlement to that money herself. And it doesn't make sense that they would become judgments automatically as a matter of law, because it would be unfair for her to receive that money without some sort of correlative obligation to turn around and make those payments with the money, or to make them in the future, or if there's some history of her having made those payments. And none of that is true here. So it's $24,986 worth of second mortgage payments that Mr. Peerat was ordered at permanent orders to pay to Mrs. Peerat. And he was also ordered to be responsible for the whole second mortgage in addition. So she had no obligation moving forward.
Ms. Mackey?
Yes.
Ms. Mackey-Murray, right? Let me ask you a few questions just so that I'm understanding this correctly. I understood from what I read that Mr. Peerat incurred this second mortgage individually, and that then Mrs. Peerat was not on that note. Is that correct?
I think there was some dispute about that and some testimony both ways, but I do believe that ultimately they found Mr. Peerat responsible for the second mortgage. I think she signed a security document, but not the actual note.
It was my understanding that there was some thought that Mr. Peerat was the individual obligor on the note, and therefore he was ordered to pay that note, and there was some question of whether or not it was a security on the marital residence. Do you know the answer to that? Was it secured by deed of trust or some other form of security on the
I don't think residence? We know the answer to that on the record as it stands right now, but I don't know that it's relevant, because if Mrs. Peerat, and in fact it may be relevant to the point that if Mrs. Peerat wasn't required to make those payments because they were his obligation, then it wouldn't make sense for her to receive a check for almost $25,000 for those payments.
And was the obligation for the second mortgage discharged in Mr. Peerat's bankruptcy?
Yes, it was. And I don't think that impacts the decision either, because again, if he doesn't have to pay them and she doesn't have to pay them, then why should he have to pay her $25,000 for those back payments?
Well, it would impact our consideration insofar as the trial court judge made the division of marital property and debts in anticipation of Mr. Peerat filing for bankruptcy, if I remember correctly.
Yes, the judge did make that decision. That's right. But I think what happened was the trial judge lumped all of those payments from the, what are called paragraph two obligations from the interim orders, lumped them all together and just made them a judgment in her favor. And during the permanent orders hearing, they had broken out the different payments and looked at those to determine which ones she had paid and which ones she hadn't. And with the 3-month delay, I think he just forgot about that discussion and instead threw them all, lumped them all together. And I think that was inappropriate.
And did the discharge in bankruptcy have any effect on the marital residence?
I don't know the answer to that question. No. I don't believe so, but I don't know the answer to that. So I'd like to jump to the voluntary unemployment, if I can, and talk about that for a minute. This court, the trial court, found that Mr. Pierrot found imputation of income on the basis that Mr. Pierrot was unemployed due to his own actions. That's the language that the court used. And that's not the correct standard. Under People v. Martinez from 2003 in the Supreme Court, the standard is whether he is shirking his child support obligations by not taking employment that's available to him. And it's Mrs. Pierrot's burden to prove that at the trial court. She did not present evidence of voluntary unemployment, and in fact, the court didn't even find voluntary unemployment and went ahead and imputed income. So we're asking this court, based on the lack of evidence in this case, to find that he was not voluntarily unemployed and remand for a recalculation of child support based on actual income.
Ms. Mackey, or is it Mackey Murray?
Which just
you,
Murray.
Okay, Ms. Murray, do you think that the trial court phrase that the husband was, Mr. Pierrot was unemployed due to his own actions was the equivalent of saying that he was shirking his child support responsibilities?
I don't believe so, but even if it was, there wasn't evidence in the case to support that. All of the evidence that was presented was that he had lost his job because of his performance, that he had disputed that with his employer, that he had submitted 150 resumes, that he had a job interview, that he didn't turn down any jobs, that he hadn't limited his job search. There was really no testimony whatsoever or evidence presented to counter any of that. And it's her burden to prove up imputation and prove voluntary unemployment. And that simply didn't happen here.
Was there any evidence that Mr. Pierrot had ever earned any income by acting as a realtor?
Not in the record in the trial court, no. I couldn't find anything in any of the transcripts anywhere that he had earned money as a realtor, no. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time unless you have any other questions.
All right, Ms. Murray, you have 7 minutes.
Thank you.
For rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Jamie Wright, registration number 35813. I'm appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Jennifer Giedel, which she is now known as, and she's the appellee. I'd like to respond, Your Honors, to Ms. Murray's discussion about the support judgment. She spoke a lot about the fact that Mr. Pierrot should be credited for certain amounts for specifically the second mortgage, which she did discuss against that support judgment, and did not address the argument in our answer brief that we do not believe that argument was preserved for appeal. And here's why. The second, we have to look at the timeline of this case, Your Honors. Mr. Pierrot was ordered to pay the second mortgage on the home in which Ms. Giedel and the children lived as part of temporary orders in April of 2009. I take issue with the fact that Ms. Murray said that the second mortgage payments was not support. It was characterized as support at least three occasions in this case. One, by virtue of the approval of the verified entry of judgment of September 4th, 2009. Second, by virtue of the approval of the verified entry judgment of June of 2010, and again in the court's permanent orders. Payments to third parties for various expenses
utilities mortgage can be characterized in the nature of support according to prevailing case law.
Ms. Wright, excuse me for interrupting, but what is the significance of that if it is characterized as for the purposes of support?
The significance of that is that support judgments become judgments automatically by operation of law when they're due and unpaid. So it's our contention that, one, Mr. Pratt was ordered to pay this mortgage as part of temporary orders in April of 2009. Each time he missed a payment on that amount, it became a judgment. Mr. Pratt never appealed the temporary orders. He never sought appeal of either of the verified entry of judgments. So I believe that's the significance.
Wasn't there an alternative argument, though, that if you're correct in that regard, then the trial court should have otherwise considered the second mortgage obligations in terms of division of marital property and allocation of debt, marital debts?
That's correct, Your Honor, and it is an equitable argument, and I think we need to look at the timelines. There was a verified entry of judgment for second mortgage expense from February of 2009, from the date of filing, until September of 2009. That was reduced to judgment, approved as an order of the court on October 28, 2009, never appealed. There was a second verified entry of judgment from September of 2009 to June of 2010. That was approved as an order of the court. That amount was never appealed. So if we're looking at expenses from June of 2010 through the date of permanent orders, our contention would be that Mr. Pratt is not entitled to any equitable relief. And the reason is that those payments were for the support of Ms. Pratt and the children. There's case law that Ms. Murray has cited, Rivera and Jacobs, indicating that equitable relief is appropriate in the Rivera case, in the instance that the parties reconciled. They had gotten back together, so they were jointly parenting the children, and that at that point, neither party should have had a support obligation.
But Ms. Wright, weren't these expenses paragraph two obligations, which were essentially marital expenses?
They were marital expenses, Your Honor, at the time of the stipulated interim orders and the temporary orders. The court, in approval of its the verified entry of judgment of September of 2009, characterized those expenses as support.
Excuse me, Ms. Wright, did the court just characterize them as support, or did the court characterize them as child support or maintenance?
There was no distinction, Your Honor, that I'm aware of.
Well, did the temporary, and I haven't had a chance to check on this yet, but did the temporary orders reflect additional amounts specifically for either temporary maintenance or temporary child support?
Yes, Your Honor, and these expenses were in addition to the spousal maintenance and the child support.
So if they were simply marital expenses, they wouldn't have become a final judgment under 1410.122 until permanent orders.
In the event there wouldn't have been approval of the verified entry of judgments, that's correct.
Okay.
I would also ask the court to consider regarding the question about the whether or not Mr. Pratt is entitled to some equitable relief or offset from the judgments. The trial court judge of permanent orders was well aware that Mr. Pratt intended to file bankruptcy. In being aware of that, he characterized those amounts as a domestic support obligation so that they could not be dischargeable. And simply because the underlying debt of the second mortgage was discharged does not render Mr. Pratt off the hook from the amounts owed pursuant to the verified entry of support judgment, which was not discharged in bankruptcy. And I think the implication by the trial court judge in making that order was that if he were to be able to discharge those amounts, Ms. Pratt and the children would be harmed. And the harm, in my opinion, and based on review of the record, is that this case went on for 2 years, and had the second mortgage was never paid. There was eviction with each month. It never happened, but that's the harm, and it could have happened. So I would ask that the court affirm the trial court's order with respect to the support judgment and the second mortgage being included in that amount.
May I inquire about that? The second mortgage obligation was husband's obligation, correct?
It was in his name. It was a marital debt.
Okay. But it was never paid.
It was never paid. That's correct.
And husband was discharged.
That's correct.
And wife is discharged from it. Or at least she has never been sued for.
Correct.
And the equity is where?
I think, again, the equity is that the trial court, knowing that Mr. Peratt would likely discharge that debt in bankruptcy, characterized that judgment for Ms. Peratt as a domestic support obligation to be non-dischargeable because she and the children were entitled to that support regardless of whether or not she ever had to pay it.
But didn't the court do that with a view to taking care of the children and the wife in the event that they paid the second mortgage?
I think the trial court did that, and I certainly don't know, but my understanding is so they could pay their housing expenses.
Let me ask you a question, Ms. Wright, please.
Sure.
Let's assume that immediately after permanent orders were entered, that Mr. Peratt paid off the second mortgage. Rather than it being discharged in bankruptcy, he paid it off. Under your argument, would there be a continuing obligation then for Mr. Peratt to continue to pay monthly payments or some sort of payments that are due on the second mortgage to Ms. Giegel?
I think under that scenario, Your Honor, the answer would be no, and the reason would be that the second mortgage was paid, so there was no risk of harm to the children being evicted. At this point, at least as part of permanent orders, Mr. Brett testified that he was going to file bankruptcy, and the court issued permanent orders under the assumption that he would, but it was still lingering.
So what's the difference between that hypothetical that I just posed and the reality that the second mortgage was discharged in bankruptcy?
I think it goes back to the risk that Ms. Peratt and the children had to endure throughout the course of the dissolution of potentially being harmed or thrown out of their house, and that was to make her whole for that. It's just as if to say he should be off the hook for paying child support because the kids, she made it just fine raising the kids, and so he should never have to pay that child support. Now, well, the kids were entitled to that support, and that's what the statute says. I'd like to turn to the imputation of income argument briefly, and I would contend in that the trial court did apply the correct legal standard, and I would agree with the court's question to Ms. Murray during her argument that the trial court judge's statement that Mr. Peratt is voluntarily unemployed due to his own actions is a finding that he's shirking his child support obligation. The trial court judge did not say that he's unemployed due to his own actions. The trial court judge said he's voluntarily unemployed due to his own actions. And I think implicit in that finding is that his post-firing conduct from his employment was not enough to show an effort that he was trying to support his kids. The trial court also found that he testified that he could obtain employment comparable to that that he enjoyed at his prior employer, and use and under the Yates case can consider his historical earnings. So I think the court applied the correct legal standard, and at this point, I think the standard becomes whether or not the court abused its discretion in imputing income to Mr. Peratt that historically he was capable of making. The trial court imputed to him the level of income the magistrate imputed to him from temporary orders, and that amount was approximately, I believe, $7,668 per month. There is record support for that amount.
And the record support is this, that he started working in approximately May of 2008, that the magistrate used his 2008 W-2, plus income paid in 2009 for work done in 2008, annualized it over the 6.5 months that he worked for 2008. And that's how she arrived at that amount of income for purposes of temporary orders. There was no projection out. It was founded in record and based on his testimony at temporary orders. Mr. Pratt also made a judicial admission in a pleading filed with this court in June of 2009 that he had no argument about the income attributed to him. And from the contempt hearing in August of 2009, the district court judge at that time found that Mr. Pratt actually had more income available to him in the amount of $8,249 per month than was even imputed to him. The district court judge stated at that hearing that his concern was that Mr. Pratt was able to find money to pay for his expenses, which he was not court ordered to pay, but he did not seem to be in a position to pay Ms. Guido's expenses, which he was under court ordered to pay. So I think in consideration of whether or not there is support in the record for the amount of income attributable to Mr. or imputed to Mr. Pratt, credibility should be considered. He was not credible in August of 2009, and there's a history of him making that amount of money that was imputed to him. So I don't perceive any error. I would ask the court to affirm the permanent orders from the trial court of May 2011. Thank you.
I'd like you, to ask you a question before you leave. In your answer brief, you make the statement in your statement of facts that that same day Jennifer Soft obtained a temporary civil protection order against Brett based on Brett's verbal abuse and property destruction. What relevancy does that have in this matter on appeal now?
Yeah, I think it was more or less laying out the timeline of the events in this case. And as far as there are no issues regarding the children on appeal, so I don't think it is relevant to the issues we're discussing today.
Thank you. You also made another statement in your answer brief talking about Jennifer filing no less than 2 contempt motions against Brett for non-payment of temporary support and about underreporting his income and spending a marital asset, the joint tax refund. What relevancy does that have in this matter on appeal?
I think the relevance, Your Honor, is that going back to my credibility concerns, is that Mr. Perrett, throughout the pendency of the dissolution action, and to even as we stand here today, has claimed he doesn't have any money and can't pay for any of the obligations he was ordered to pay. When Ms. Perrett filed the contempt motions, and in fact Mr. Perrett was found to be in remedial contempt because he did have the ability to pay those obligations that he was court ordered to pay. So I believe that's the relevance.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. Ms. Marie, I have 7 minutes. 7 minutes and 2 seconds.
Just a few things, Your Honors. In paragraph 27 of the permanent orders, the court stated, respondent has been unemployed since November of 2010 due to his own actions. And that is the sum total of his discussion of voluntary unemployment. So he didn't use the word voluntary unemployment. It's not clear that he applied the correct standard. In fact, there's no evidence that he applied the correct standard here. We're not appealing. She made reference to a verified entry of support that included payments made from February to August of 2008, I believe, and we're not appealing those, so that's not relevant to this particular appeal. And I'm not aware of a verified entry of support judgment or the amounts that were appealing that was entered before permanent orders. There are many bills that the parties didn't pay, the second mortgage being one of them. There were pretty difficult financial circumstances for both parties in this case, resulting in 2 bankruptcies. And I think the second mortgage was one of those payments.
And I don't think there was any testimony in the record at all that he felt like he was able to achieve employment at the same rate that he was earning at Swanson. In fact, his testimony was to the contrary. And I believe that's the only thing I have to say with regards to that. If you have any other questions about any of these matters, I'm willing to answer them at this time.
Wasn't it appropriate for the trial court to consider Mr. Perrott's prior earnings in terms of imputing income to him?
The trial court didn't consider any actual annual salary that he had made. If you read through the temporary orders where the judge discussed the calculation of the 6 months of bonuses and whatnot, what he did was he took his base salary and divided it by 12 months. And then he took 6 months worth of bonuses that he had earned, and she divided that by 6 months. And then she took additional bonus that was earned in 2009, divided that by 6 months, and came up with a monthly salary and multiplied it by 12. So it wasn't ever a 12-month period of time. It never reflected his annual earnings. And he has all of his tax records were part of the record, and at no point did he ever make $92,000 a year.
Well, is there some requirement that a trial court has to average income over a certain period of time before determining the amount of income that may be imputed to a spouse?
There are some cases that discuss it. I think it's Connerton v. Nevin that talked about it having to be annual income, or at least referenced annual income. It's kind of like if you had earned a commission 1 month out of the year, and you earned $50,000 in November, and then the judge decided you could earn $50,000 a month. It's also an equitable question. So taking the 6 months of bonuses and assuming that he could continue to earn it at that rate, by the time we got to permanent orders, it proved to be incorrect. And so at permanent orders, the court had the ability to make a reasonable and equitable calculation of imputation, assuming that he was voluntarily unemployed. And so just adopting the magistrate's ruling point blank without reconsidering whether that proved to be true was error.
And as I understand it, the Perrott did not object or would not object to imputation of income in the range of $75,000. He thought that's what should have been imputed to him.
If he was voluntarily unemployed, however, he was not voluntarily unemployed. That's a threshold question that has to be determined before you can impute income.
Yeah.
So that's in the event the court concludes that there was evidence to support voluntary unemployment, which we contend there isn't, and decides that imputation is correct, then that imputation was also an incorrect number. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Murray.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Ms. Wright. This matter is being submitted. You can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes